If I had better data on places lived throughout childhood, since many people grow up in different counties than the one where they were born. The success of college towns and big cities is striking when you just look at the data, but I also delve more deeply to undertake a more sophisticated, empirical analysis. Doing so showed that there was another variable that was a strong predictor of a person securing an entry in Wikipedia, the proportion of immigrants in your county of birth. The greater the percentage of foreign-born residents in an area, the higher the proportion of children born there who go on to notable success. Take that, Donald Trump. If two places have similar urban and college populations, the one with more immigrants will produce more prominent Americans. What explains this? A lot of it seems to be directly attributable to the children of immigrants. I did an exhaustive search of the biographies of the 100 most famous white baby boomers, according to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Pantheon Project, which is also working with Wikipedia data. Most of these were entertainers. At least 13 had foreign-born mothers, including Oliver Stone, Sandra Bullock, and Julianne Moore. This rate is more than 3 times higher than the national average during this period. Many had fathers who were immigrants, including Steve Jobs and John Belushi, but this data was more difficult to compare to national averages, since information on fathers is not always included on birth certificates. What about variables that don't impact success? One that I found more than a little surprising was how much money a state spends on education. In states with similar percentages of its residents living in urban areas, education spending did not correlate with rates of producing notable writers, artists, or business leaders. It is interesting to compare my Wikipedia study to one of Chetty's team's studies discussed earlier. Recall that Chetty's team was trying to figure out what areas are good at allowing people to reach the upper middle class. My study was trying to figure out what areas are good at allowing people to reach fame. The results are strikingly different. Spending a lot on education helps kids reach the upper middle class. It does little to help them become a notable writer, artist, or business leader. Many of these huge successes hated school. Some dropped out. New York City, Chetty's team found, is not a particularly good place to raise a child if you want to ensure he reaches the upper middle class. It is a great place, my study found, if you want to give him a chance at fame. When you look at the factors that drive success, the large variation between counties begins to make sense. Many counties combine all the main ingredients for success, return again to Boston. With numerous universities, it is stewing in innovative ideas. It is an urban area with many extremely accomplished people offering youngsters examples of how to make it, and it draws plenty of immigrants whose children are driven to apply these lessons. What if an area has none of these qualities? Is it destined to produce fewer superstars? Not necessarily. There is another path, extreme specialization. Roseau County, Minnesota, a small rural county with few foreigners and no major universities, is a good example. Roughly 1 in 740 people born here made it into Wikipedia. Their secret? All 9 were professional hockey players, no doubt helped by the county's world-class youth and high school hockey programs. So is the point here, assuming you're not so interested in raising a hockey star, to move to Boston or Tuskegee if you want to give your future children the utmost advantage? It can't hurt, but there are larger lessons here. Usually, economists and sociologists focus on how to avoid bad outcomes, such as poverty and crime. Yet the goal of a great society is not only to leave fewer people behind, it is to help as many people as possible to really stand out. Perhaps this effort to zoom in on the places where hundreds of thousands of the most famous Americans were born can give us some initial strategies. Encouraging immigration, subsidizing universities, and supporting the arts among them. Usually I study the United States. So when I think of zooming in by geography, I think of zooming in on our cities and towns, of looking at places like Macon County, Alabama, and Roseau County, Minnesota. But another huge and still growing advantage of data from the Internet is that it is easy to collect data from around the world. We can then see how countries differ, and data scientists get an opportunity to tiptoe into anthropology. One somewhat random topic I recently explored, how does pregnancy play out in different countries around the world? I examined Google searches by pregnant women. The first thing I found was a striking similarity in the physical symptoms about which women complain. I tested how often various symptoms were searched in combination with the word pregnant. For example, how often is pregnant searched in conjunction with nausea, back pain, or constipation? Canada's symptoms were very close to those in the United States. Symptoms in countries like Britain, Australia, and India were all roughly similar, too. Pregnant women around the world apparently also crave the same things. In the United States, the top Google search in this category is craving ice during pregnancy. The next four are salt, sweets, fruit, and spicy food. In Australia, those cravings don't differ all that much. The list features salt, sweets, chocolate, ice, and fruit. What about India? A similar story. Spicy food, sweets, chocolate, salt, and ice cream. In fact, the top five are very similar in all of the countries I looked at. Preliminary evidence suggests that no part of the world has stumbled upon a diet or environment that drastically changes the physical experience of pregnancy. But the thoughts that surround pregnancy most definitely do differ. Start with questions about what pregnant women can safely do. The top questions in the United States: can pregnant women eat shrimp, drink wine, drink coffee, or take Tylenol? When it comes to such concerns, other countries don't have much in common with the United States or one another. Whether pregnant women can drink wine is not among the top 10 questions in Canada, Australia, or Britain. Australia's concerns are mostly related to eating dairy products while pregnant, particularly cream cheese. In Nigeria, where 30% of the population uses the internet, the top question is whether pregnant women can drink cold water. Are these worries legitimate? It depends. There is strong evidence that pregnant women are at an increased risk of listeria from unpasteurized cheese. Links have been established between drinking too much alcohol and negative outcomes for the child. In some parts of the world, it is believed that drinking cold water can give your baby pneumonia. I don't know of any medical support for this. The huge differences in questions posed around the world are most likely caused by the overwhelming flood of information coming from disparate sources in each country. Legitimate scientific studies, so-so scientific studies, old wives' tales, and neighborhood chatter. It is difficult for women to know what to focus on or what to Google. We can see another clear difference when we look at the top searches for how to blank during pregnancy. In the United States, Australia, and Canada, the top search is how to prevent stretch marks during pregnancy. But in Ghana, India, and Nigeria, preventing stretch marks is not even in the top five. These countries tend to be more concerned with how to have sex or how to sleep. Take a look at the enhancement for the comparisons. Top five searches in order for how to blank during pregnancy. United States, prevent stretch marks, lose weight, have sex, avoid stretch marks, stay fit. India, sleep, do sex, take care. Australia, prevent stretch marks, lose weight, avoid stretch marks, sleep, have sex. Britain, lose weight, prevent stretch marks, avoid stretch marks, sleep, have sex. Nigeria, have sex, lose weight, make love, stay healthy, stop vomiting. South Africa, have sex, lose weight, prevent stretch marks, sleep, stop vomiting. Top five searches beginning with can pregnant women blank. United States, eat shrimp, drink wine, drink coffee, take Tylenol, eat sushi. Britain, eat prawns, eat smoked salmon, eat cheesecake, eat mozzarella, eat mayonnaise. Australia, eat cream cheese, eat prawns, eat bacon, eat sour cream, eat feta cheese. Nigeria, drink cold water, drink wine, drink coffee, have sex, take moringa, edible plant. Singapore, drink green tea, eat ice cream, eat durian, drink coffee, eat pineapple. Spain, eat pate, eat jamón, take paracetamol, pain relief, eat tuna, sunbathe. Germany, fly, eat salami, go in sauna, eat honey, eat mozzarella. Brazil, dye their hair, take dipirona, pain relief, take paracetamol, ride a bike, fly. There is undoubtedly more to learn from zooming in on aspects of health and culture in different corners of the world. But my preliminary analysis suggests that big data will tell us that humans are even less powerful than we realized when it comes to transcending our biology, yet we come up with remarkably different interpretations of what it all means. How we fill our minutes and hours. The adventures of a young man whose principal interests are rape, ultraviolence, and Beethoven. That was how Stanley Kubrick's controversial A Clockwork Orange was advertised. In the movie, the fictional young protagonist, Alex DeLarge, committed shocking acts of violence with chilling detachment. In one of the film's most notorious scenes, he raped a woman while belting out Singin' in the Rain. Almost immediately, there were reports of copycat incidents. Indeed, a group of men raped a 17-year-old girl while singing the same song. The movie was shut down in many European countries, and some of the more shocking scenes were removed for a version shown in America. There are, in fact, many examples of real-life imitating art, with men seemingly hypnotized by what they had just seen on screen. A showing of the gang movie Colors was followed by a violent shooting. A showing of the gang movie New Jack City was followed by riots. Perhaps most disturbing, 4 days after the release of The Money Train, men used lighter fluid to ignite a subway toll booth, almost perfectly mimicking a scene in the film. The only difference between the fictional and real-world arson, in the movie, the operator escaped. In real life, he burned to death. There is also some evidence from psychological experiments that subjects exposed to a violent film will report more anger and hostility, even if they don't precisely imitate one of the scenes. In other words, anecdotes and experiments suggest violent movies can incite violent behavior. But how big an effect do they really have? Are we talking about one or two murders every decade, or hundreds of murders every year? Anecdotes and experiments can't answer this. To see if big data could, two economists, Gordon Dahl and Stefano Della Vigna, merged together three big data sets for the years 1995 to 2004, FBI hourly crime data, box office numbers, and a measure of the violence in every movie from kidsinmind.com. The information they were using was complete. Every movie and every crime committed in every hour in cities throughout the United States. This would prove important. Key to their study was the fact that on some weekends, the most popular movie was a violent one, Hannibal or Dawn of the Dead, for example, while on other weekends, the most popular movie was nonviolent, such as Runaway Bride or Toy Story. The economists could see exactly how many murders, rapes, and assaults were committed on weekends when a prominent violent movie was released, and compare that to the number of murders, rapes, and assaults there were on weekends when a prominent peaceful movie was released. So what did they find? When a violent movie was shown, did crime rise, as some experiments suggest, or did it stay the same? On weekends with a popular violent movie, the economists found crime dropped. You heard that right. On weekends with a popular violent movie, when millions of Americans were exposed to images of men killing other men, crime dropped significantly. When you get a result this strange and unexpected, your first thought is that you've done something wrong. Each author carefully went over the coding. No mistakes. Your second thought is that there is some other variable that will explain these results. They checked if time of year affected the results. It didn't. They collected data on weather, thinking perhaps somehow this was driving the relationship. It wasn't. We checked all our assumptions, everything we were doing, Dahl told me. We couldn't find anything wrong. Despite the anecdotes, despite the lab evidence, and as bizarre as it seemed, showing a violent movie somehow caused a big drop in crime. How could this possibly be? The key to figuring it out for Dahl and Della Vigna was utilizing their big data to zoom in closer. Survey data traditionally provided information that was annual or at best perhaps monthly. If we are really lucky, we might get data for a weekend. By comparison, as we've increasingly been using comprehensive data sets rather than small sample surveys, we have been able to home in by the hour and even the minute. This has allowed us to learn a lot more about human behavior. Sometimes fluctuations over time are amusing, if not earth-shattering. EPCOR, a utility company in Edmonton, Canada, reported minute-by-minute water consumption data during the 2010 Olympic gold medal hockey match between the United States and Canada, which an estimated 80% of Canadians watched. The data tells us that shortly after each period ended, water consumption shot up. Toilets across Edmonton were clearly flushing. Google searches can also be broken down by the minute, revealing some interesting patterns in the process. For example, searches for unblocked games soar at 8 a.m. on weekdays and stay high through 3 p.m., no doubt in response to schools' attempts to block access to mobile games on school property without banning students' cell phones. Search rates for weather, prayer, and news peak before 5:30 a.m., evidence that most people wake up far earlier than I do. Search rates for suicide peak at 12:36 a.m. and are at the lowest levels around 9 a.m., evidence that most people are far less miserable in the morning than I am. The data shows that the hours between 2 and 4 a.m. are prime time for big questions. What is the meaning of consciousness? Does free will exist? Is there life on other planets? The popularity of these questions late at night may be a result in part of cannabis use. Search rates for how to roll a joint peak between 1 and 2 a.m. And in their largest data set, Dahl and Della Vigna could look at how crime changed by the hour on those movies weekends. They found that the drop in crime when popular violent movies were shown, relative to other weekends, began in the early evening. Crime was lower, in other words, before the violent scenes even started, when theatergoers may have just been walking in. Can you guess why? Think first about who is likely to choose to attend a violent movie. It's young men, particularly young aggressive men. Think next about where crimes tend to be committed. Rarely in a movie theater. There have been exceptions, most notably a 2012 premeditated shooting in a Colorado theater, but by and large, men go to theaters unarmed and sit silently. Offer young aggressive men the chance to see Hannibal, and they will go to the movies. Offer young aggressive men Runaway Bride as their option, and they will take a pass and instead go out, perhaps to a bar, club, or a pool hall, where the incidence of violent crime is higher. Violent movies keep potentially violent people off the streets. Puzzle solved, right? Not quite yet. There was one more strange thing in the data. The effect started right when the movie started showing. However, they did not stop after the movie ended and the theater closed. On evenings where violent movies were showing, crime was lower well into the night, from midnight to 6 a.m. Even if crime was lower while the young men were in the movie theater, shouldn't it rise after they left and were no longer preoccupied? They had just watched a violent movie, which experiments say makes people more angry and aggressive. Can you think of any explanations for why crime still dropped after the movie ended? After much thought, the authors who were crime experts had another aha moment. They knew that alcohol is a major contributor to crime. The authors had sat in enough movie theaters to know that virtually no theaters in the United States serve liquor. Indeed, the authors found that alcohol-related crimes plummeted in late-night hours after violent movies. Of course, Dahl and Della Vigna's results were limited. They could not, for instance, test the months-out lasting effects to see how long the drop in crime might last, and it's still possible that consistent exposure to violent movies ultimately leads to more violence. However, their study does put the immediate impact of violent movies, which has been the main theme in these experiments, into perspective. Perhaps a violent movie does influence some people and make them unusually angry and aggressive. However, do you know what undeniably influences people in a violent direction? Hanging out with other potentially violent men and drinking. This story shows how things that seem bad may be good if they prevent something worse. Ed McCaffrey, a Stanford-educated former wide receiver, uses this argument to justify letting all four of his sons play football. These guys have energy, and so if they're not playing football, they're skateboarding, they're climbing trees, they're playing tag in the backyard, they're doing paintball. I mean, they're not going to sit there and do nothing. And so the way I look at it is, hey, at least there's rules within the sport of football. My kids have been to the emergency room for falling off decks, getting in bike crashes, skateboarding, falling out of trees. I mean, you name it. Yeah, it's a violent collision sport, but also my guys just have the personality where at least they're not squirrel jumping off mountains and doing crazy stuff like that. So it's organized aggression, I guess. McCaffrey's argument, made in an interview on The Herd with Colin Cowherd, is one I had never heard before. After reading the Dahl Delavigna paper, I take the argument seriously. An advantage of huge real-world data sets rather than laboratory data is that they can pick up these kinds of effects. Well, this makes sense now, but it didn't make sense before Dahl and Delavigna began analyzing piles of data. One more important point that becomes clear when we zoom in. The world is complicated. Actions we take today can have distant effects, most of them unintended. Ideas spread, sometimes slowly, other times exponentially, like viruses. People respond in unpredictable ways to incentives. These connections and relationships, these surges and swells, cannot be traced with tiny surveys or traditional data methods. The world, quite simply, is too complex and too rich for little data. Our doppelgangers. In June 2009, David Big Poppy Ortiz looked like he was done. During the previous half-decade, Boston had fallen in love with their Dominican-born slugger with the friendly smile and gapped teeth. He had made 5 consecutive All-Star games, won an MVP award, and helped end Boston's 86-year championship drought. But in the 2008 season, at the age of 32, his numbers fell off. His batting average had dropped 68 points, his on-base percentage 76 points, his slugging percentage 114 points, and at the start of the 2009 season, Ortiz's numbers were dropping further. Here's how Bill Simmons, a sports writer and passionate Boston Red Sox fan, described what was happening in the early months of the 2009 season. It's clear that David Ortiz no longer excels at baseball. Beefy sluggers are like porn stars, wrestlers, NBA centers, and trophy wives. When it goes, it goes. Great sports fans trust their eyes, and Simmons' eyes told him Ortiz was finished. In fact, Simmons predicted he would be benched or released shortly. Was Ortiz really finished? If you're the Boston general manager in 2009, do you cut him? More generally, how can we predict how a baseball player will perform in the future? Even more generally, how can we use big data to predict what people will do in the future? A theory that will get you far in data science is this. Look at what sabermetricians, those who have used data to study baseball, have done and expect it to spread out to other areas of data science. Baseball was among the first fields with comprehensive data sets on just about everything, and an army of smart people willing to devote their lives to making sense of that data. Now, just about every field is there or getting there. Baseball comes first. Every other field follows. Sabermetrics eats the world. The simplest way to predict a baseball player's future is to assume he will continue performing as he currently is. If a player has struggled for the past 1.5 years, you might guess that he will struggle for the next 1.5 years. By this methodology, Boston should have cut David Ortiz. However, there might be more relevant information. In the 1980s, Bill James, who most considered the founder of sabermetrics, emphasized the importance of age. Baseball players, James found, peaked early at around the age of 27. Teams tended to ignore just how much players decline as they age. They overpaid for aging players. By this more advanced methodology, Boston should definitely have cut David Ortiz. But this age adjustment might miss something. Not all players follow the same path through life. Some players might peak at 23, others at 32. Short players may age differently from tall players, fat players from skinny players. Baseball statisticians found that there were types of players each following a different aging path. This story was even worse for Ortiz. Beefy sluggers indeed do, on average, peak early and collapse shortly past 30. If Boston considered his recent past, his age, and his size, they should without a doubt have cut David Ortiz. Then in 2003, statistician Nate Silver introduced a new model which he called PECOTA to predict player performance. It proved to be the best and also the coolest. Silver searched for players' doppelgangers. Here's how it works. Build a database of every Major League Baseball player ever, more than 18,000 men, and include everything you know about those players, their height, age and position, their home runs, batting average, walks and strikeouts for each year of their careers. Now find the 20 ball players who look most similar to Ortiz right up until that point in his career. Those who played like he did when he was 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, and 33. In other words, find his doppelgangers. Then see how Ortiz's doppelganger's careers progressed. A doppelganger search is another example of zooming in. It zooms in on the small subset of people most similar to a given person. And, as with all zooming in, it gets better the more data you have. It turns out Ortiz's doppelgangers gave a very different prediction for Ortiz's future. Ortiz's doppelgangers included Jorge Posada and Jim Thome. These players started their careers a bit slow, had amazing bursts in their late 20s with world-class power, and then struggled in their early 30s. Silver then predicted how Ortiz would do based on how these doppelgangers ended up doing. And here's what he found. They regained their power. For trophy wives, Simmons may be right. When it goes, it goes. But for Ortiz's doppelgangers, when it went, it came back. The doppelganger search, the best methodology ever used to predict baseball player performance, said Boston should be patient with Ortiz. And Boston indeed was patient with their aging slugger. In 2010, Ortiz's average rose to 270. He hit 32 home runs and made the All-Star team. This began a string of four consecutive All-Star games for Ortiz. In 2013, batting in his traditional third spot in the lineup at the age of 37, Ortiz batted .688 as Boston defeated St. Louis 4-2 in the World Series. Ortiz was voted World Series MVP. You can probably tell by this part of the book I tend to be cynical about good stories. I wanted one feel-good story in here, so I am leaving my cynicism to a footnote. I suspect PECOTA just found out that Ortiz was a steroid user who stopped using steroids and would start using them again. From the standpoint of prediction, it is actually pretty cool if PECOTA was able to detect that, but it makes it a less moving story. As soon as I finished reading Nate Silver's approach to predicting the trajectory of ballplayers, I immediately began thinking about whether I might have a doppelganger too. Doppelganger searches are promising in many fields, not just athletics. Could I find the person who shares the most interests with me? Maybe if I found the person most similar to me, we could hang out. Maybe he would know some restaurants we would like. Maybe he could introduce me to things I had no idea I might have an affinity for. A doppelganger search zooms in on individuals and even on the traits of individuals. And as with all zooming in, it gets sharper the more data you have. Suppose I searched for my doppelganger in a data set of 10 or so people. I might find someone who shared my interest in books. Suppose I searched for my doppelganger in a data set of 1,000 or so people. I might find someone who had a thing for popular physics books. But suppose I searched for my doppelganger in a data set of hundreds of millions of people. Then I might be able to find someone who was really, truly similar to me. One day I went doppelganger hunting on social media. Using the entire corpus of Twitter profiles, I looked for the people on the planet who have the most common interests with me. You can certainly tell a lot about my interests from whom I follow on my Twitter account. Overall, I follow some 250 people, showing my passions for sports, politics, comedy, science, and morose Jewish folk singers. So is there anybody out there in the universe who follows all 250 of these accounts? My Twitter twin? Of course not. Doppelgangers aren't identical to us, only similar. Nor is there anybody who follows 200 of the accounts I follow, or even 150. However, I did eventually find an account that followed an amazing 100 of the accounts I follow, Country Music Radio Today. Huh? It turns out Country Music Radio Today was a bot, it no longer exists, that followed 750,000 Twitter profiles in the hope that they would follow back. I have an ex-girlfriend who I suspect would get a kick out of this result. She once told me I was more like a robot than a human being. All joking aside, my initial finding that my doppelganger was a bot that followed 750,000 random accounts does make an important point about doppelganger searches. For a doppelganger search to be truly accurate, you don't want to find someone who merely likes the same things you like. You also want to find someone who dislikes the things you dislike. My interests are apparent not just from the accounts I follow, but from those I choose not to follow. I am interested in sports, politics, comedy, and science, but not food, fashion, or theater. My follows show that I like Bernie Sanders, but not Elizabeth Warren, Sarah Silverman, but not Amy Schumer, The New Yorker, but not The Atlantic, my friends Noah Popp, Emily Sands, and Josh Gottlieb, but not my friend Sam Asher. Sorry, Sam, but your Twitter feed is a snooze. Of all 200 million people on Twitter, who has the most similar profile to me? It turns out my doppelganger is Vox writer Dylan Matthews. This was kind of a letdown for the purposes of improving my media consumption, as I already follow Matthews on Twitter and Facebook and compulsively read his Vox posts. So learning he was my doppelganger hasn't really changed my life. But it's still pretty cool to know the person most similar to you in the world, especially if it's someone you admire. And when I finish Everybody Lies and stop being a hermit, maybe Matthews and I can hang out and discuss the writings of James Surowiecki. The Ortiz doppelganger search was neat for baseball fans, and my doppelganger search was entertaining, at least to me. But what else can these searches reveal? For one thing, doppelganger searches have been used by many of the biggest internet companies to dramatically improve their offerings and user experience. Amazon uses something like a doppelganger search to suggest what books you might like. They see what people similar to you select and base their recommendations on that. Pandora does the same in picking what songs you might want to listen to, and this is how Netflix figures out the movies you might like. The impact has been so profound that when Amazon engineer Greg Linden originally introduced doppelganger searches to predict readers' book preferences, the improvement in recommendations was so good that Amazon founder Jeff Bezos got to his knees and shouted, "I'm not worthy," to Linden. But what is really interesting about doppelganger searches considering their power is not how they're commonly being used now, it's how frequently they're not used. There are major areas of life that could be vastly improved by the kind of personalization these searches allow. Take our health, for instance. Isaac Cohane, a computer scientist and medical researcher at Harvard, is trying to bring this principle to medicine. He wants to organize and collect all of our health information so that instead of using a one-size-fits-all approach, doctors can find patients just like you. Then they can employ more personalized, more focused diagnoses and treatments. Cohane considers this a natural extension for the medical field and not even a particularly radical one. What is a diagnosis? Cohane asks. A diagnosis really is a statement that you share properties with previously studied populations. When I diagnose you with a heart attack, God forbid, I say you have a pathophysiology that I learned from other people means you have had a heart attack. A diagnosis is in essence a primitive kind of doppelganger search. The problem is that the data sets doctors use to make their diagnoses are small. These days a diagnosis is based on a doctor's experience with the population of patients he or she has treated and perhaps supplemented by academic papers from small populations that other researchers have encountered. As we've seen, though, for a doppelganger search to really get good, it would have to include many more cases. Here is a field where some big data could really help. So what's taking so long? Why isn't it already widely used? The problem lies with data collection. Most medical reports still exist on paper, buried in files, and for those that are computerized, they're often locked up in incompatible formats. We often have better data, Cohen notes, on baseball than on health. But simple measures would go a long way. Cohen talks repeatedly of low-hanging fruit. He believes, for instance, that merely creating a complete data set of children's height and weight charts and any diseases they might have would be revolutionary for pediatrics. Each child's growth path then could be compared to every other child's growth path. A computer could find children who were on a similar trajectory and automatically flag any troubling patterns. It might detect a child's height leveling off prematurely, which in certain scenarios would likely point to one of two possible causes, hypothyroidism or a brain tumor. Early diagnosis in both cases would be a huge boon. These are rare birds, according to Cohen, one in 10,000 kind of events. Children, by and large, are healthy. I think we could diagnose them earlier, at least a year earlier. 100% we could. James Haywood is an entrepreneur who has a different approach to deal with difficulties linking medical data. He created a website, patientslikeme.com, where individuals can report their own information, their conditions, treatments, and side effects. He's already had a lot of success charting the varying courses diseases can take and how they compare to our common understanding of them. His goal is to recruit enough people, covering enough conditions, so that people can find their health doppelganger. Haywood hopes that you can find people of your age and gender with your history, reporting symptoms similar to yours, and see what has worked for them. That would be a very different kind of medicine indeed. Data stories. In many ways, the act of zooming in is more valuable to me than the particular findings of a particular study, because it offers a new way of seeing and talking about life. When people learn that I am a data scientist and a writer, they sometimes will share some fact or survey with me. I often find this data boring, static, and lifeless. It has no story to tell. Likewise, friends have tried to get me to join them in reading novels and biographies, but these hold little interest for me as well. I always find myself asking, would that happen in other situations? What's the more general principle? Their stories feel small and unrepresentative. What I have tried to present in Everybody Lies is something that for me is like nothing else. It is based on data and numbers. It is illustrative and far-reaching, and yet the data is so rich that you can visualize the people underneath it. When we zoom in on every minute of Edmonton's water consumption, I see the people getting up from their couch at the end of the period. When we zoom in on people moving from Philadelphia to Miami and starting to cheat on their taxes, I see these people talking to their neighbors in their apartment complex and learning about the tax trick. When we zoom in on baseball fans of every age, I see my own childhood and my brother's childhood and millions of adult men still crying over a team that won them over when they were 8 years old. At the risk of once again sounding grandiose, I think the economists and data scientists featured in Everybody Lies are creating not only a new tool, but a new genre. What I have tried to present in this chapter and much of this audiobook is data so big and so rich, allowing us to zoom in so close that without limiting ourselves to any particular unrepresentative human being, we can still tell complex and evocative stories. 6. All the World's a Lab. February 27, 2000, started as an ordinary day on Google's Mountain View campus. The sun was shining, the bikers were pedaling, the masseuses were massaging, the employees were hydrating with cucumber water. And then, on this ordinary day, a few Google engineers had an idea that unlocked the secret that today drives much of the internet. The engineers found the best way to get you clicking, coming back, and staying on their sites. Before describing what they did, we need to talk about correlation versus causality, a huge issue in data analysis, and one that we have not yet adequately addressed. The media bombard us with correlation-based studies, seemingly every day. For example, we have been told that those of us who drink a moderate amount of alcohol tend to be in better health. That is a correlation. Does this mean drinking a moderate amount will improve one's health? A causation? Perhaps not. It could be that good health causes people to drink a moderate amount. Social scientists call this reverse causation. Or it could be that there is an independent factor that causes both moderate drinking and good health. Perhaps spending a lot of time with friends leads to both alcohol consumption and good health. Social scientists call this omitted variable bias. How then can we more accurately establish causality? The gold standard is a randomized controlled experiment. Here's how it works. You randomly divide people into two groups. One, the treatment group, is asked to do or take something. The other, the control group, is not. You then see how each group responds. The difference in the outcomes between the two groups is your causal effect. For example, to test whether moderate drinking causes good health, you might randomly pick some people to drink one glass of wine per day for a year, randomly choose others to drink no alcohol for a year, and then compare the reported health of both groups. Since people were randomly assigned to the two groups, there is no reason to expect one group would have better initial health or have socialized more. You can trust that the effects of the wine are causal. Randomized, controlled experiments are the most trusted evidence in any field. If a pill can pass a randomized, controlled experiment, it can be dispensed to the general populace. If it cannot pass this test, it won't make it onto pharmacy shelves. Random experiments have increasingly been used in the social sciences as well. Esther Duflo, a French economist at MIT, has led the campaign for greater use of experiments in developmental economics, a field that tries to figure out the best ways to help the poorest people in the world. Consider Duflo's study with colleagues of how to improve education in rural India, where more than half of middle school students cannot read a simple sentence. One potential reason students struggle so much is that teachers don't show up consistently. On a given day in some schools in rural India, more than 40% of teachers are absent. Duflo's test? She and her colleagues randomly divided schools into two groups. In one, the treatment group, in addition to their base pay, teachers were paid a small amount, 50 rupees, or about $1.15, for every day they showed up to work. In the other, no extra payment for attendance was given. The results were remarkable. When teachers were paid, teacher absenteeism dropped in half. Student test performance also improved substantially, with the biggest effects on young girls. By the end of the experiment, girls in schools where teachers were paid to come to class were 7 percentage points more likely to be able to write. According to a New Yorker article, when Bill Gates learned of Duflo's work, he was so impressed he told her, "We need to fund you." The ABCs of A-B testing. So randomized experiments are the gold standard for proving causality, and their use has spread through the social sciences, which brings us back to Google's offices on February 27, 2000. What did Google do on that day that revolutionized the Internet? On that day, a few engineers decided to perform an experiment on Google's site. They randomly divided users into two groups. The treatment group was shown 20 links on the search results pages. The control group was shown the usual 10. The engineers then compared the satisfaction of the two groups based on how frequently they returned to Google. This is a revolution? It doesn't seem so revolutionary. I already noted that randomized experiments have been used by pharmaceutical companies and social scientists. How can copying them be such a big deal? The key point, and this was quickly realized by the Google engineers, is that experiments in the digital world have a huge advantage relative to experiments in the offline world. As convincing as offline randomized experiments can be, they are also resource-intensive. For Duflo's study, schools had to be contacted, funding had to be arranged, some teachers had to be paid, and all students had to be tested. Offline experiments can cost thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars and take months or years to conduct. In the digital world, randomized experiments can be cheap and fast. You don't need to recruit and pay participants. Instead, you can write a line of code to randomly assign them to a group. You don't need users to fill out surveys. Instead, you can measure mouse movements and clicks. You don't need to hand code and analyze the responses. You can build a program to automatically do that for you. You don't have to contact anybody. You don't even have to tell users they are part of an experiment. This is the fourth power of big data. It makes randomized experiments, which can find truly causal effects, much, much easier to conduct, anytime, more or less anywhere, as long as you're online. In the era of big data, all the world's a lab. This insight quickly spread through Google and then the rest of Silicon Valley, where randomized controlled experiments have been renamed A-B testing. In 2011, Google engineers ran 7,000 A-B tests, and this number is only rising. If Google wants to know how to get more people to click on ads on their sites, they may try two shades of blue in ads, one shade for Group A, another for Group B. Google can then compare click rates. Of course, the ease of such testing can lead to overuse. Some employees felt that because testing was so effortless, Google was over-experimenting. In 2009, one frustrated designer quit after Google went through 41 marginally different shades of blue in A-B testing. But this designer's stand in favor of art over obsessive market research has done little to stop the spread of the methodology. Facebook now runs 1,000 A-B tests per day, which means that a small number of engineers at Facebook start more randomized controlled experiments in a given day than the entire pharmaceutical industry starts in a year. A-B testing has spread beyond the biggest tech firms. A former Google employee, Dan Siriker, brought this methodology to Barack Obama's first presidential campaign, which A-B tested homepage designs, email pitches, and donation forms. Then Siriker started a new company, Optimizely, which allows organizations to perform rapid A-B testing. In 2012, Optimizely was used by Obama as well as his opponent Mitt Romney to maximize signups, volunteers, and donations. It's also used by companies as diverse as Netflix, TaskRabbit, and New York Magazine. To see how valuable testing can be, consider how Obama used it to get more people engaged with his campaign. Obama's homepage initially included a picture of the candidate and a button below the picture that invited people to sign up. It's reproduced on the enhancement. Was this the best way to greet people? With the help of Optimizely, Obama's team could test whether a different picture and button might get more people to actually sign up. Would more people click if the homepage instead featured a picture of Obama with a more solemn face? Would more people click if the button instead said, "Join now"? Obama's team showed users different combinations of pictures and buttons and measured how many of them clicked the button. And take a look at the images on the enhancement and see if you can predict the winning picture and winning button. The buttons tested were "Join us now," "Learn more," and "Sign up." The winner was the picture of Obama's family and the button "Learn more." And the victory was huge. By using that combination, Obama's campaign team estimated it got 40% more people to sign up, netting the campaign roughly $60 million in additional funding. There is another great benefit to the fact that all this gold standard testing can be done so cheap and easy. It further frees us from our reliance upon our intuition, which, as noted in Chapter 1, has its limitations. A fundamental reason for A-B testing's importance is that people are unpredictable. Our intuition often fails to predict how they will respond. Was your intuition correct on Obama's optimal website? On the enhancement are some tests. I predict you got more than half right, perhaps by considering what you would click on, but you probably did not guess all of these correctly. Why? What did you miss? What insights into human behavior did you lack? What lessons can you learn from your mistakes? We usually ask questions such as these after making bad predictions, but look how difficult it is to draw general conclusions from the Globe headlines. In the first headline test, changing a single word, "this," to "snotbot" led to a big win. This might suggest more details win, but in the second headline, "deflated balls," the detailed term loses. In the fourth headline, "makes bank," beats the number $179,000. This might suggest slang terms win, but the slang term "hookup contest" loses in the third headline. The lesson of A-B testing to a large degree is to be wary of general lessons. Clark Benson is the CEO of Ranker.com, a news and entertainment site that relies heavily on A-B testing to choose headlines and site design. At the end of the day, you can't assume anything, Benson says. Test literally everything. Testing fills in gaps in our understanding of human nature. These gaps will always exist. If we knew, based on our life experience, what the answer would be, testing would not be of value. But we don't, so it is. Another reason A-B testing is so important is that seemingly small changes can have big effects. As Benson puts it, I'm constantly amazed with minor factors having outsized value in testing. In December 2012, Google changed its advertisements. They added a rightward-pointing arrow surrounded by a square. Take a look at the images on the enhancement. Notice how bizarre this arrow is. It points rightward to absolutely nothing. In fact, when these arrows first appeared, many Google customers were critical. Why were they adding meaningless arrows to the ad, they wondered. Well, Google is protective of its business secrets, so they don't say exactly how valuable the arrows were, but they did say that these arrows had won in A-B testing. The reason Google added them is that they got a lot more people to click. And this minor, seemingly meaningless change made Google and their ad partners oodles of money. So how can you find these small tweaks that produce outsized profits? You have to test lots of things, even many that seem trivial. In fact, Google's users have noted numerous times that ads have been changed a tiny bit, only to return to their previous form. They have unwittingly become members of treatment groups in A-B tests, but at the cost only of seeing these slight variations. Take a look at the visuals on the enhancement. The variations on the enhancements never made it to the masses. They lost, but they were part of the process of picking winners. The road to a clickable arrow is paved with ugly stars, faulty positionings, and gimmicky fonts. It may be fun to guess what makes people click, and if you're a Democrat, it might be nice to know that testing got Obama more money, but there is a dark side to A-B testing. In his excellent book, Irresistible, Adam Alter writes about the rise of behavioral addictions in contemporary society. Many people are finding aspects of the internet increasingly difficult to turn off. My favorite dataset, Google searches, can give us some clues as to what people find most addictive. According to Google, most addictions remain the ones people have struggled with for many decades, drugs, sex, and alcohol, for example, but the internet is starting to make its presence felt on the list, with porn and Facebook now among the top 10 reported addictions. Top addictions reported to Google 2016. Drugs, sex, porn, alcohol, sugar, love, gambling, Facebook. A-B testing may be playing a role in making the internet so darn addictive. Tristan Harris, a design ethicist, was quoted in Irresistible, explaining why people have such a hard time resisting certain sites on the internet. Quote, there are 1,000 people on the other side of the screen whose job it is to break down the self-regulation you have. And these people are using A-B testing. Through testing, Facebook may figure out that making a particular button a particular color gets people to come back to their site more often, so they change the button to that color. Then they may figure out that a particular font gets people to come back to their site more often, so they change the text to that font. Then they may figure out that emailing people at a certain time gets them coming back to their site more often, so they email people at that time. Pretty soon, Facebook becomes a site optimized to maximize how much time people spend on Facebook. In other words, find enough winners of A-B tests and you have an addictive site. It is the type of feedback that cigarette companies never had. A-B testing is increasingly a tool of the gaming industry. As Alter discusses, World of Warcraft A-B tests various versions of its game. One mission might ask you to kill someone, another might ask you to save something. Game designers can give different samples of players different missions and then see which ones keep more people playing. They might find, for example, that the mission that asked you to save a person got people to return 30% more often. If they test many, many missions, they start finding more and more winners. These 30% wins add up until they have a game that keeps many adult men holed up in their parents' basement. If you are a little disturbed by this, I am with you, and we will talk a bit more about the ethical implications of this and other aspects of big data near the end of this audiobook. But, for better or worse, experimentation is now a crucial tool in the data scientist's toolkit, and there is another form of experimentation sitting in that toolkit. It has been used to ask a variety of questions, including whether TV ads really work. Nature's cruel but enlightening experiments. It's January 22, 2012, and the New England Patriots are playing the Baltimore Ravens in the AFC Championship game. There's a minute left in the game. The Ravens are down, but they've got the ball. The next 60 seconds will determine which team will play in the Super Bowl. The next 60 seconds will help seal players' legacies, and the last minute of this game will do something that for an economist is far more profound. The last 60 seconds will help finally tell us once and for all, do advertisements work? The notion that ads improve sales is obviously crucial to our economy, but it is maddeningly hard to prove. In fact, this is a textbook example of exactly how difficult it is to distinguish between correlation and causation. There's no doubt that products that advertise the most also have the highest sales. 20th Century Fox spent $150 million marketing the movie Avatar, which became the highest-grossing film of all time. But how much of the $2.7 billion in Avatar ticket sales was due to the heavy marketing? Part of the reason 20th Century Fox spent so much money on promotion was presumably that they knew they had a desirable product. Firms believe they know how effective their ads are. Economists are skeptical they really do. The University of Chicago economics professor Stephen Levitt, while collaborating with an electronics company, was underwhelmed when the firm tried to convince him they knew how much their ads worked. How, Levitt wondered, could they be so confident? The company explained that every year, in the days preceding Father's Day, they ramp up their TV ad spending. Sure enough, every year before Father's Day, they have the highest sales. Maybe that's just because a lot of kids buy electronics for their dads, particularly for Father's Day gifts, regardless of advertising. They got the causality completely backwards, says Levitt in a lecture. At least they might have, we don't know. It's a really hard problem, Levitt adds. As important as this problem is to solve, firms are reluctant to conduct rigorous experiments. Levitt tried to convince the electronics company to perform a randomized, controlled experiment to precisely learn how effective their TV ads were. Since A/B testing isn't possible on television yet, this would require seeing what happens without advertising in some areas. Here's how the firm responded. Are you crazy? We can't not advertise in 20 markets. The CEO would kill us. That ended Levitt's collaboration with the company. Which brings us back to this Patriots-Ravens game. How can the results of a football game help us determine the causal effects of advertising? Well, it can't tell us the effects of a particular ad campaign from a particular company, but it can give evidence on the average effects of advertisements from many large campaigns. It turns out there is a hidden advertising experiment in games like this. Here's how it works. By the time these championship games are played, companies have purchased and produced their Super Bowl advertisements. When businesses decide which ads to run, they don't know which teams will play in the game. But the results of the playoffs will have a huge impact on who actually watches the Super Bowl. The two teams that ultimately qualify will bring with them an enormous amount of viewers. If New England, which plays near Boston, wins, far more people in Boston will watch the Super Bowl than folks in Baltimore, and vice versa. To the firms, it is the equivalent of a coin flip to determine whether tens of thousands of extra people in Baltimore or Boston will be exposed to their advertisement, a flip that will happen after their spots are purchased and produced. Now back to the field, where Jim Nantz on CBS is announcing the final results of this experiment. Here comes Billy Cundiff to tie this game, and in all likelihood, send it to overtime. The last 2 years, 16 of 16 on field goals. 32 yards to tie it, and the kick. Look out, look out.